This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
So here's the way the economy breaks down in late spring 2016. We are either doing fine, treading water, or completely out of luck. Worker productivity is the metric du jour. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 2nd of May. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Productivity in a minute, but there are some other good rule of thumb indicators you can use to take the macroeconomic temperature. Jobs and unemployment, of course. I like to keep an eye on the bond market myself. Also, mergers and acquisitions. Companies feeling good enough about things to buy up their competitors. And to that end, this item, a $28 billion merger between oilfield services providers Halliburton and Baker Hughes, fell apart over the weekend. The deal would have brought together the world's second and third largest such companies had not regulators made their objections known. Last month, another big wannabe deal was scrapped between pharma giants Pfizer and Allergan, also after regulators intervened. Marketplace's Andy Baxter gets us going with why regulators seem to be looking at mergers more closely.
There are a lot of reasons regulators are taking a tough stance on mega mergers lately. So says Mark Ostrow, chair of the antitrust practice at the law firm Fenwick & West. He says mega mergers are complex and can have impacts on a lot of different markets, both in the U.S. and elsewhere.
They tend to include market leaders, so there's a natural concern with you might be creating a monopoly or an oligopoly with just two or three big players, and there's more chance that there's lots of competitive overlaps that can't easily be fixed by just divesting a few products.
Antitrust expert Herb Hovenkamp at the University of Iowa doesn't think the size of merger partners is the sole factor drawing scrutiny. He says deals involving smaller firms can create unfair competition, too. He says the bigger deal is that some studies have suggested the government hasn't been strict enough limiting certain deals, and that's making it pay more attention today.
Because what the studies have generally showed is that if you look at mergers that are kind of right on the edge, but where the government permitted them to go ahead, prices have gone up in those markets. That's been true in airlines. It's been true in groceries, drugs.
He also thinks the government is on a bit of a winning streak lately, and that's emboldening it to be tougher on mergers. But mergers and acquisitions lawyer Richard Brand thinks a lot of the regulatory scrutiny actually boils down to politics.
And so if the government has the tools to block a politically unpopular deal, they might just use them.
Brand says corporate boards considering mergers need to brace themselves accordingly. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
All right, so also on the economic progress checklist, besides mergers and all the rest, worker productivity, as I mentioned up top. And the news there is not good. Neil Irwin wrote about it at the Upshot at the New York Times. Neil, it's good to have you back on.
Thanks for having me.
Am I overstating the case if I say that productivity-wise and economic growth-wise, we're basically spinning our wheels now with these numbers looking the way they are?
Yeah, that's about right. We got this number the other day, 0.5% growth in the first quarter. That's not that good. And if it was just one quarter, that'd be one thing. But we've seen this for year after year now. We're seeing this glacial growth. Every third quarter, we seem to have a negative quarter. So we're not seeing the kind of economic growth we'd like to see.
And productivity is key to that, right? More widgets produced per hour worked, right?
That's right, because the problem going on is not that the job market isn't expanding. We're adding hundreds of thousands of jobs a month. The unemployment rate keeps falling. That's all good news. But when that's not matched by growth in output, growth in GDP, that's a sign something bad is happening with productivity, the ability of each hour of work to produce more goods and services.
All right, so what gives?
Well, we don't know for sure. That's one of the things about productivity. It's one of the most important things in the economy, but also the least understood. We don't really know what drives productivity trends all that well. So I have a few theories, though.
All right. So item one on your list, you call it the bad or the depressing possibility.
Yeah, so this is the idea that we're just in a slump. We're just in a technological slump for reasons that we can't really control. Combine that with the recession a few years ago and depressed business investment, so there hasn't been investment in equipment and software. This is just not a good period for American workers to be producing more stuff for every hour they put in.
And you call it depressing when, in point of fact, it's really, really bad, right? Because if we're stuck, we're stuck.
It is. If that's something that we can't fix, that we can't change, that implies that people are not going to get wealthier over time. It implies that if it continues forever, it means that your grandkids are going to make no more money than you do. And that's a very depressing scenario for the long term.
It is possible, though, that it's a bit less bad than that, your neutral scenario.
Yeah, so there's a possibility that we're just not understanding what's really going on in the economy right now, that there's measurement error, that there's things happening that make the official statistics not really indicators one way or the other of what's happening. So one of these is we have all these technologies coming out that GDP and other economic statistics are really bad at tracking. You know, how do you even account for smartphones and the revolution around social media, these things? These are things people spend a lot of time doing. They help, you know, they improve people's lives, and yet they're not really terribly well accounted for in the economic statistics.
My favorite example in this piece is, who knows what people at Facebook do every day anyway?
Yeah, is this a situation where they're becoming more productive and we just don't understand it because the official statistics that were, you know, they were developed in the 1930s in an industrial economy. You know, maybe we're just having trouble really understanding what's happening in the economy because our statistics aren't keeping up.
And then finally, you say that it could be we're just in a lull, that it's actually okay and it's going to get better, and here's why.
Yeah, here's one way to think of it. There's a lot of innovation happening right now beneath the surface that we don't see, that's not turning into economic output. So think about the people at Google working on autonomous cars, driverless cars. Those aren't creating GDP right now. They aren't, you know, those are actually depressing productivity right now. But if some of these bets pay off and really generate major gains in the future, we'll forget about this entire conversation because we'll have outstanding growth in the years ahead and much more productivity in the decades ahead.
All right, so put up or shut up. Which one of these is the more likely scenario?
Look, I veer more optimistic. I think there's a lot of interesting investments happening right now. That said, there's some measurement error, too. I go between 2 and 3, I guess, is my leaning.
Which is better than 1, right?
It's a lot better than 1.
Neil Irwin is a senior economics correspondent at the New York Times. His piece on productivity is in the Upshot. Neil, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Traders were moderately productive. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is a big week for North Korea. The official Workers' Party of North Korea will hold its first Congress in nearly 40 years and affirm Kim Jong-un's rule over that country. North Korea might have a nuclear bomb and long-range rockets, but almost everything modern you see there comes from China. The mobile phones, computers, cars, the regime can barely feed its own people. But there is money in North Korea, more than there was 12 years ago. The BBC's Steve Evans is in Pyongyang with a group of Nobel laureates, seeing a bit of the money being spent to make things look as good as possible.
It's May Day showtime in Pyongyang. Sanctions are tight, Kim Jong-un's nuclear ambitions remain unabated. But the beat goes on with the National Symphony Orchestra, players who also sing. I'm following three Western Nobel laureates in this hyper-isolated country. Their visit is controversial because of North Korea's brutal human rights record. But they want to see scientific institutions for themselves. At Pyongyang Children's Hospital, we were shown around.
How many beds?
More than 300 beds.
We saw an impressive new-looking scanner.
You see, it's all Siemens. It's all Siemens. It's a million-dollar piece.
Rooms with children on treadmills recovering strength after illness. Girls reading at desks because hospital means no school. But Dr. Sir Richard Roberts, winner of the Nobel Prize for Medicine, was not convinced he was seeing the hospital as it really is.
It looked as though it was staged so that it would look good for us. If you just look at the little room we went into with the kids on the exercise machines, they didn't just happen to be there as we walked through.
So, you know, the monument's name is the Tower of the Zhuqi Idea.
All work and no play makes for a dull Nobel laureate. So they see the city sights, of course.
We are going up to the top body of the tower, which is 150 meters, just under the torch.
At the top of the tower, the panorama of Pyongyang before us, Professor Aaron Chechenova from Israel, who won the Chemistry Nobel Prize, told me why he's here.
We are in a mission of peace, truly a mission of peace, and I truly believe that science and technology is the ultimate language of peace. And I believe that we are doing something important.
On Friday, though, the visit of the laureates will be overshadowed. The fanfare then will be for Kim Jong-un at the Congress of the Workers' Party, the first one for nearly 40 years. He will be applauded with almost religious rapture until hands are raw. In the meantime, he may get in another nuclear test. The harmony here is only on stage.
That was the BBC Steve Evans from Pyongyang, North Korea. If you're an observant participant in the economy that surrounds you, surely you have noticed. I mean, how could you not have? They're all over the place out there. Mattress stores is what I'm talking about. You know the ones. Big showrooms full of beds of every kind. Yet, if you look inside as you drive by, often the only person in there is a lonely salesman who looks, honestly, like he needs a nap. Mattress stores, it turns out, aren't just thriving, they are multiplying. One industry analyst figures we're going to add 700 more of them in this country in the next 5 years. From Chicago, Derek John has more on what gives with that.
Amy Aarons Terpstra is one of the people losing sleep over the sudden explosion in mattress stores she's noticed on her daily commute. She recently took me for a drive through Chicago's South Loop.
At my last count, there was 5 mattress stores either on or right off Roosevelt Road.
2 of those stores are from the same company, the one called Mattress Firm.
So here's our second mattress firm. What are we at, in Canal? But there's not only that, there's another one right around the corner. American Mattress, it's right there. See it?
Right across.
They could throw a stone at each other.
And let's not even talk about another shopping strip on the north side that has 10 mattress stores in less than a mile. Now, retail clustering is nothing new, but unlike a burger and fries, a mattress is not exactly an impulse buy.
Honestly, I have bought one mattress in my entire adult life, and I just cannot conceive of how a city can sustain so many mattress stores.
And it's not just Chicago. In the past decade, the number of specialty mattress stores has jumped from 7,000 to nearly 10,000 stores nationwide.
There's no snoozing on the job in this industry.
That's Dave Perry, betting editor for the trade magazine Furniture Today. And after 33 years of reporting on mattresses, you end up using a lot of puns.
I do sometimes, I have to admit. It's a wide-awake marketing plan. Companies got bounce in their sales.
But seriously, Perry says nowadays there's a greater awareness of the benefits of sleep. Baby boomers are upgrading to fancier mattresses. And despite some online startups, so far, mattress shopping is largely internet-proof.
The only way you can really test the comfort of the mattress is to lie down on it. So I think the brick-and-mortar stores have a very big advantage.
Finally, where people used to replace their mattress every 10 to 15 years, now they're doing it more often. In fact, Mattress Firm's slogan is replace every 8. Sam Woods is the company's senior vice president of sales.
When that consumer says, I'm fed up, I can't sleep on this bed any longer, we want them to think, hey, there's a Mattress Firm right over there.
And over there and over there. The Houston-based company has been gobbling up its rivals. It just acquired Sleepy's and is now in 48 states. Turns out mattress stores are a good business to be in. They have high profit margins, low overhead, and typically just one salesperson.
Yeah, so if you think about it, if you sold 3 or 4 beds a day and your average ticket is $1,000, well, you know, that's $4,000 a day times 365. All of a sudden, you've got, you know, over $1 million business there.
Okay, but why have multiple Mattress Firm stores right next to each other? Wood says he used to wonder the same thing, but then he discovered something unexpected. As Mattress Firm began taking over the competition across the street, he figured they would close the weakest store.
Well, what happens is that often those two stores will both improve their performance. And so we're like, maybe we'll keep them both open.
That ubiquity is now part of their strategy, since each new store can also double as advertising. Now, remember Amy, the skeptical consumer? By the end of our drive, she was singing a different tune.
I think I might need a new mattress.
In Chicago, I'm Derek John for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it was really going to be a very earnest book. It really was going to be about how the system works.
But it turned into American Psycho. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 117 points today, about 2/3%, finished at 17,891. The NASDAQ up 42 points, 9/10%, 4817. The S&P 500, 16 points higher, 3/4%, 2,081. Halliburton, we told you about them earlier, up 1 8/10% today. Baker Hughes down 2%. Flush with cash now that the deal is off. Baker Hughes now has plans to buy back stock and debt. Apollo Education Group, which runs the University of Phoenix, climbed 12 4/10% after a group of investors raised its bid for the company to $1.14 billion. Apple, in its eighth loss in a row, down 1/10%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. One of modern technology's biggest mysteries was solved today. Maybe. An Australian computer scientist named Craig Wright announced today that he is Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous inventor of Bitcoin. If those claims turn out to be true, and there are strong feelings, both for and against, Wright stands to get credit not just for creating a digital currency, but also for creating the technology that makes it work. And that technology could be a much bigger game changer than Bitcoin itself. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on that.
The thing that makes Bitcoins work is that you can check their authenticity just like checking the hologram on paper currency. Peter Todd is a Bitcoin developer.
In Bitcoin, the key thing is all Bitcoins are in one big chain.
That chain, for all 15 million Bitcoins out there, is blocks of data that keep track of all transactions ever. This is otherwise known as a blockchain. And Todd says a blockchain can be used not just for Bitcoins, but
any time when you have data where it's bad if there's two different things that could have happened to it.
Such as in real estate transactions where you have to be sure that the house you're buying wasn't also sold to someone else. Campbell Harvey is a professor of finance at Duke University. He says blockchain used in real estate would allow you to simply check a digital register instead of enduring a long title search.
That transaction could happen instantly. Another good example is buying stocks.
Which is what the state of Delaware said today it's working on. Governor Jack Markell announced the initiative this morning, saying blockchain corporate stock trades hold the promise of
immediate clearance, immediate settlement, and bringing with them dramatic increases in efficiency and speed in the sophisticated commercial transactions for which Delaware is known.
The governor said the state has also started a pilot program to move public archives onto blockchain. Duke's Campbell Harvey says hundreds, if not thousands, of other companies are working on other potential uses for blockchain. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
The hottest thing in higher education right now, as of like yesterday, the gap year. The White House announced yesterday Malia Obama is going to Harvard, but not till the fall of 2017 after her dad's out of a job. She's going to take a gap year after she finishes high school next month, giving a boost to a growing industry. From the Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Malia Obama's plans were revealed just as the American Gap Association, yes, there is such a thing, kicked off its second annual Gap Year conference in Boston.
It was pretty interesting timing, actually. There was quite a lot of encouragement.
The association's Carl Hagler estimates each year 30 to 40,000 students take time off. That's a tiny fraction of college students, but a number he says has grown along with the intense pressure on kids to achieve.
A lot of students are expressing the need to take a break and really begin to get a better sense of who they are and what they want to do with their lives.
Dozens of programs have cropped up to help them through outdoor adventure, community service, or international travel. Drew Edwards directs Carpe Diem Education, which offers structured experiences in places like Latin America, Southeast Asia, and Africa.
Whether you're backpacking to Machu Picchu, whether you're doing some sort of volunteer work, it's not just,
hey, I'm doing this cool thing, but where is this going to fit into to my life as a whole?
All that self-discovery doesn't come cheap. An 8-month program runs about $19,000, though there are scholarships for low-income students. The University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, started a global gap year fellowship to make the experience more accessible. Admissions director Steve Farmer says around 40 students a year, or about 1% of the entering class, take time off first.
And most of them haven't involved a program. They've just involved students doing something that they thought was worthwhile.
And those students typically do better when they do start school. A study at UNC and Middlebury College found that students who took gap years had higher than predicted GPAs. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Twenty-five years ago, we were introduced to the character of Patrick Bateman, the villainous, to put it mildly, banker at the heart of Bret Easton Ellis' novel American Psycho. After the book came the movie starring Christian Bale. Now comes a Broadway musical in which you can watch Bateman's gory killing spree unfold over a danceable 1980s soundtrack. I promise I am not making this up. So far, the show has tallied a respectable $2 million in advance ticket sales, many of them quite possibly to young Wall Streeters. But Bateman's return also gives us a chance to look at how banking has changed since we first met him. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York.
This is what being Patrick Bateman means to me.
That's Benjamin Walker, star of the new Broadway play. Seeing audiences giggle and cheer their way through the synth-heavy musical, it's hard to remember how much trouble the novel stirred up when it came out 25 years ago. The original publisher dropped the book, and the author got death threats as critics ripped American Psycho for its brutal violence, particularly against women. Today, the same story doesn't provoke protests. The audience just laughs at the narcissistic 26-year-old investment banker.
It's hip to be square.
Patrick chops up a business rival with an axe as Huey Lewis blares, the audience goes nuts, like they just saw a touchdown pass. During intermission, the smartphone set scrambles to the front to get shots of crews mopping up all the stage blood. Even though Bateman's a Wall Street guy and countless scenes are set in his bank, there's almost no discussion of banking in the novel, film, or musical. All the office talk is food, women, clothes, and famously business cards. Novelist Bret Easton Ellis says that wasn't his original plan.
It was really going to be a very earnest book. It really was going to be about how the system works.
He changed focus after he started hanging out with young bankers who hardly had anything to say about what they actually did at work.
They wanted to show off their suits. They wanted to show off who could get the best table in a restaurant, who was dating the hottest girl. And so what happened was that what was supposed to be a novel about the banking system in 1986, 87, 88 really became a much more experimental kind of hallucinatory investigation into lifestyle.
From today's viewpoint, we know Bateman's period as a time when banking ceased to be something most people could understand and turned far more complex, mysterious, and opaque, even to some inside finance. In the 80s, Wall Street ramped up repackaging of home loans into complex products. It was an interesting idea at the time, but it mutated over the years into the explosive material of the financial crisis. Even Bateman's vivid imagination couldn't conjure how much bigger and more complex banking has gotten.
There are gods, there are kings, I'm pretty sure I'm the same thing. Beyond boundaries, beyond rules, I've been taught in the best schools. There is little I won't do, I'm not like you.
Patrick Bateman is born into money and gets richer on Wall Street. He's a one percenter in today's language. In the quarter century since the novel came out, the gap between rich and poor has chasmed. Many of the rich banker's victims tend to be from the other end of the spectrum. A homeless person, sex workers, a taxi driver. It makes this late 80s tale seem pretty current after Occupy Wall Street and the ongoing debate over income inequality.
It's about lack of empathy. And that's very easy to have when you are wealthy and you live in a bubble.
We're not complaining because the cash keeps raining, so I don't know, don't know, don't know. You want it all.
It's left to you to decide whether Bateman is truly murderous or if the carnage is all in his mind. As for Wall Street guys, Ellis says the ones he's met over the years love the character. They proudly share pictures of their Bateman Halloween costumes, typically a blood-soaked raincoat like the one available for $15 at the souvenir stand of the musical. People often ask where Bateman would work if the novel were set in 2016.
I don't know if Patrick would be chasing that particular dream, or else if he would be doing something that was quote-unquote cooler, trendier.
Since the financial crisis, Wall Street isn't quite the magnet it used to be, lacking the prestige and swashbuckling glamour of the 80s. The Patrick Bateman of today just might be working in Silicon Valley, buying absurdly expensive coffee, tailoring his hoodies, and plotting how to lure the next victim into his Pacific Heights Victorian. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a lawsuit which at first glance will be easy to poo-poo, but once you think about it, does kind of make some sense. A disgruntled Starbucks customer in Chicago has filed a $5 million suit against the company, saying it puts too much ice in its iced drinks, specifically noticing that a large, I personally refuse to say venti, a large iced drink is supposed to have 24 fluid ounces in it, but which in reality only contains 14 ounces of actual liquid, the rest being ice. So there is that. Also, don't forget the dilution effects once the ice melts. It's less of a drink. A Starbucks spokesperson said, quote, our customers understand and expect that ice is an essential component of any iced beverage, end of quote. Okay, but still. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 117 today, 2/3%. The NASDAQ up 42, 9/10%. The S&P 500 up 16, 3/4%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.